Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Three, two, one.
Dime. I'm Christina Gomez, your hostess for the next 35 to 45 minutes of live streaming adventure and UFO shenanigans, where we look and think outside the box, jump down rabbit holes, and where the red pill is actually a red Tic Tac. If you haven't had your paradigm shifted, get ready. Big announcement. So tomorrow morning, I will be opening up my supporter Discord server so it is available to everyone. So if you want to get access and join the cool conversations, discussions, and debates, keep an eye on my Twitter feed for the invitation link. So let's get into this. I'm excited to introduce to you my guest for tonight's live stream, writer and journalist Jazz Shaw. Jazz is a U.S. Navy veteran who studied electronics technology and English. She's a journalist who has covered the energy industry and government policy, and for the last 5 years, the UFO phenomenon. He's obsessed with the strange and the unusual. Jazz currently contributes written articles to The Debrief, among others, and is a prolific writer on a wide variety of topics. He also made sure to put in his bio that he can teach anyone how to mix a perfect martini in 2 minutes or less. So he might have to take him up on that, and maybe he can give us a demonstration at some point. So please welcome with me, Mr. Jazz Shaw. Hi, Jazz.
Christina, pleasure to be here. First time on the show with you, although we've spoken many times.
Oh, many times with Luis Jimenez. And I know your day has been incredibly long today. So the fact that you made time for this live stream really means a lot for me. And we're going to really cut down it to maybe 35 minutes because you got to sleep, man. I feel it.
This morning, just behind the scenes stuff for everybody who's listening. This morning, Christina sent me a note and said, "How do you get up so early?" And right now at the start of the show, I have to ask all of the younger people who are watching and doing these things, how do you stay up so late? And normally I'm going to bed by now, sometimes before now, and I get up around 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, on East Coast time. So yeah, it's an adventure I'm launching out into here to be like, well, maybe I should talk to some of the young people instead of just yelling at them to get off my lawn, you know.
I love it. I bet you're one of the best people to go to the house for trick-or-treating. I bet you just scare them.
Oh, yeah. We don't even scare them that much. My wife's huge into trick-or-treating, and we didn't have it last year, of course. But no, right. We always have huge bags of candy. I keep the good candy for myself, but we give out the other, you know, crap to the kids and, you know, just take pictures of the trick-or-treaters and their costumes and stuff. We really enjoy Halloween.
Me too. One of my all-time favorite holidays. You get to dress up, you get free candy, you get to have fun, and it's not too hot, you know. It's like a perfect holiday in one.
It's the right time of year. Yes.
Oh yeah. So let's get started on to back when you used to work for the United States Navy. Can you tell us a little bit about your career in it and where it took you in life?
I was already interested in technology, and I had started going to school for electronics technology, and pretty much I you have to realize how old I am. Back in that time, almost all the men of my family enlisted in the military. It was just what you did, you know.
And what year was this?
That was in the mid 1970s. I actually enlisted in 1976, and let me see, that would be what, 100 years before you were born, something like that. So, yeah, I went enlisted, and I went to basic training, and I went through like basic electronics and technology school. I went to a school to learn radar systems. And that I was a radar maintenance technician slash occasionally operator working on a few different ships, primarily aircraft carriers on the West Coast in the late 70s and early 80s.
And can you, for people that aren't part of the military, can you just kind of describe what basic training is, like just a little umbrella?
That's boot camp. When you hear the phrase boot camp, no matter if you're any enlisted person as opposed to officers who have a separate style of boot camp, when you go to basic training, you go to a place where they sort of mentally and physically break you down and build you back up again and get you in a military mindset and determine whether or not you're the kind of person they can send off to war.
Right.
And if you don't, then they flunk you out. And if you are, then, you know, you're given your orders and you put on the uniform and you go out and serve. And, you know, basic training is, I won't lie to anybody who's considering that career now. It's very difficult. It's physically difficult. It's mentally and emotionally difficult, but they have to build a fighting force that they can rely on that's ready to serve as members of the military. So everybody goes through boot camp, basic training. And then after that, depending what career path you choose, there are options for other schools that you can qualify for and go to. Pretty much any job in the world that you can imagine, there's a military equivalent, and they have a school for that, and you go through those schools, and then eventually you're sent out and you get deployed to serve on ships, on submarines, alternating, if you stay in long enough for shore duty, you know, at some of the land bases, weapons bases, things like that. And switching back and forth. I signed up for 6 years, so I only did six. And then I went into a civilian career after that.
So during your time in the Navy, were there any occasions where you were confronted with the strange or mysterious or anything UFO related, it being either rumors or gossip or even an encounter?
Not back then, no. I didn't have any, well, we had a lot of strange and unusual encounters. I was in during the Cold War. I was serving during the Iran hostage crisis towards the end of my career. And we spent a lot of time out in the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea, just circling endlessly, waiting for orders to attack Iran that never came. We saw a lot of weird stuff, but you would occasionally see some weird lights in the sky, but no, we never had UFO sightings that were talked about. USO, that's a different situation. Submerged objects. Being in radar, we were friends with the guys in sonar. And even back then, there were occasions where they reported what are called fast movers. And the phrase is still in use today. And actually, I think, yeah, Tim McMillan had a couple articles about fast movers over the debrief. You know, the sonar guys would pick up stuff every once in a while, not all the time, but there would be stuff coming over the radio in Combat Information Center. It's like, oh, we got a fast mover. And normally things you detect under the water, you're looking for submarines, number one, obviously. You pick up other stuff like whales, biological things. Nothing moves terribly fast under the water because the water is so thick, you know. And every once in a while, you'd get something that would produce a return that indicated that it was going like more than 100 knots or 200 knots, like hundreds of miles per hour. Nothing can go that fast under the water, or so we always assumed. And those were always written off as, oh, it's a sonar error. It must be an equipment error because that's not possible. And you would basically just log it and move on. But no, that was really the only things. We saw a lot of weird things. Like I thought we saw sea monsters several times, you know, while we were out, you know, really huge things. And there's a lot of interesting natural phenomena when you're out at sea. You can see bioluminescence in the ocean when you cut through areas where the microbes in the water, when you disturb them, they just start making light and they make like these underwater rainbows, you know. So there's amazing things to see at sea. But no, we not in my personal experience, sorry to disappoint everybody. We were never involved in any activities, and I was in combat information center all the time. On the ships I was on, we never had anything that would approach like a UFO encounter like the stuff that's being discussed today. No.
And you just mentioned about sea monsters. The things that you did see in the ocean, what kind of gave it away, or what made you lead to that assumption that they were these kinds of odd creatures?
It's what sailors call sea stories. You see weird stuff out there, and nobody has a good explanation for it. You would see occasionally, particularly when you get down near Australia and down near close to the Antarctic, occasionally you would just see these large ridges that would come up out of the water, you know, and then they would submerge, and there's nothing showing up on sonar. But back then, everybody smoked cigarettes, but you weren't allowed inside the skin of the ship, so you'd be standing out towards the aft end of the ship and just, you know, sort of watching the night sky or the day sky or whatever. And every once in a while down there, you would just see these huge things. Maybe they were whales surfacing, but some of them look really long and skinny for whales. So yeah, everybody has stories like that. You see weird things out at sea. The Brits have a saying, worse things happen at sea. You know, a lot of strange stuff happens when you're out in the real depths of the ocean and far from land. You see strange stuff. You know, is any of it, I don't know, paranormal? I don't know. It's probably, we used to think giant squid were fake, right? It was just like stories. And the last 10 years, they've actually caught giant squid. You know, they exist. You know, so there's a lot of weird stuff in the ocean.
And before we go to the next question, I just want to clarify, when you're in the Navy, you're trained to see like regular sea creatures and submarines and things of this nature, right? Like it's a part of your boot camp.
Sea creatures, no, they don't teach you marine biology. Craft and vessels, yeah, you're trained to look for all the normal surface vessels. You're trained to look for submarines, how they display themselves, particularly if you're in radar. You're trained to look for if there is a submarine in the area, you know, has a conning tower or a periscope popped up, things like that. All the normal surface ships. And again, as I think I mentioned already, this was during the Cold War. We were constantly, because it was an aircraft carrier group, we were constantly trailed by Soviet fishing vessels that had no nets and like 5,000 antennas on them that were always following you around. So you always had to watch them and keep track of what they were doing. But no, not so much sea creatures. No, nobody trained us on that.
Not yet. Maybe in today's world, that'd be awesome if it was.
Maybe they're doing it now. You know, I've been out for quite a while, so.
Also, when you were in the Navy, were you already journaling or writing during your time, or was that something that you evolved into doing once you left the Navy?
I was writing, but it was technical writing strictly, and I went into the private sector as a technical writer initially, instead of doing more of what you would consider mainstream journalism. It was writing like technical manuals, documentation of technical analysis for equipment, things like that. That evolved over time where I started writing about technology in general. And then I expanded out because I was also studying the energy industry. And I started writing about that. And that led to work just being basically a reporter covering the energy industry. And then that led into government policy and how that interacted with the energy industry and American energy policy, things like that. And then it was really only in the last 7 years or so where I started getting off into all sorts of other weird things that people asked me to write about, which eventually led to UFOs. And here we are today.
And here we are today because some of your articles are really something else. People that haven't read them, 100% recommend reading Jazz Shaw's articles through all of the platforms that you do. Because you do multiple, how many platforms are you on that you write articles?
I primarily write for Salem Media. That's my main job that supports me, my day job. I write about UFOs there, but also a lot of other energy and government policy stuff. I write at The Debrief, as you already said. I write for National Review. I get invited to do some articles like for Washington Monthly and a few other places. So yeah, I'm kind of spread around, but yeah, it's mostly Salem Media and The Debrief.
And you mentioned in your bio that you started covering the UFO topic 5 years ago in your writing, or maybe seven, right? So 5 to 7 years. But realistically, it is safe to assume that you've always had an interest in the strange and the mysterious, if not UFOs specifically, right?
Oh, my entire life. Yeah. But I see, we're living right now in a time where you have the luxury of going and starting a show like this and talking about these things. And you could still be taken seriously as a journalist, as a broadcaster, as an analyst. This is a recent phenomenon. If you talked about this stuff any time before 2017, I mean, that recently, but particularly if you go back into the early 2000s of the 90s, if you wrote anything about that, you were a kook. And that would really limit your career options. So I did very little coverage. I had to, this is a story I've told a couple other people, for Salem, my primary outlet, in the end of 2017, when the big New York Times article came out, I actually waited a couple of weeks after New Year's to the first week of January 2018. I had to go and approach the management of our company and say, hey, did you see this New York Times thing? I think this is important. We might want to talk about this. Can I write about this? And I actually had to go get permission to write my first UFO article. And I didn't get it immediately. And they came back and they were like, well, okay, we'll give it a try and see how it goes. Don't get too crazy. It turned out to be one of the highest traffic articles we had for the entire month. And I went back and did a couple more, and then they finally were like, you don't have to ask anymore. Okay, you're the UFO guy. So at that point, I became the UFO guy, which I didn't have a problem with. And it was good for the company, and it was good for me. And it was something I was really passionate about and had been for my entire life. And then it was like this confluence where I finally had the chance to do it professionally and write about it. And I'd been studying it for a long time. And then I got to really research it and start. I've probably written 200 or 300 articles on the subject now. But yeah, it really wasn't until then. Before that, it was sort of taboo.
That's so exciting. How did you even get interested in a UFO topic? How did that start?
I was not seriously looking into the topic as a real thing until fairly late in life. I was always interested, but I was interested, I think, like a lot of people from my generation in the 60s and 70s. Again, you would think of that as the Stone Age, long before you were born. I liked science fiction books and movies, you know, and later on, even in the 90s, you know, huge X-Files fan. But at no time was I sitting there going, oh, well, this is probably absolutely real. I thought it was fascinating. In an abstract sense, I think I always felt that this is a vast universe. There's probably other life out there, but is it visiting us here? I hadn't seen anything really conclusive. I heard about Roswell and all that, but you hear the government's response to Roswell and what's going on or what went on at that time. And they always sow those seeds of doubt in your mind. And I really don't think it was until the last 10 years or so where I started to go, you know, just say to myself, you know, this could actually be real. Before that, it was mostly fiction and entertainment for me. And, right. But there were so many people talking about it, obsessing over it. And the deeper I looked, the more I started to obsess over it. And then that crossed over into my professional career. And now here we are. Like I said, again, I'm the UFO guy for our network. So
Moose asks, are the objects coming from space, ocean, or both?
Oh, the objects. Okay. Well, the answer is all of the above from what we've seen. Transmedium objects. Take the Tic Tac incident, you know, some of the other related ones, things that were dropping down to 80,000 feet before they were picked up. Certainly seems likely they were coming from at least low Earth orbit, right? Dropping down to sea level, some things going into the water, coming back out of the water. We're just already discussing the transmedium vehicles, the fast movers. So it's pretty much all of the above. I mean, they show up from everywhere. The classified report that we didn't get to see that Congress was given, we've heard hints about what was talked about in those 143 unidentified incidents. You know, it covers the whole spectrum. You know, every altitude you can imagine, under the water, in and out of the water, and out in space, things that were picked up by satellite cameras. So I think we're talking a phenomena that covers pretty much every medium you can imagine.
I couldn't agree more with you on that one. And you just mentioned the report, and that's something I wanted to ask you about. Because, you know, a lot, like, most people were getting hyped up about its release. But what about you? Was it what you expected? Can you kind of tell me your thoughts about its content as a preliminary report?
Well, assuming it's a preliminary report, it sounds like we'll get more work done in the future. But what we got, I was actually, and I've told a few people this, pretty satisfied with it, primarily because I had set my expectations so low. I was going to be shocked if, frankly, if they told us anything, you know, because we're talking about 70 or 80 years of lies and obfuscation from the government, you know. And the fact that they said as many things as they did in that report, like, well, these aren't all just weather phenomena. They're not seagulls. They're not, you know, these are things that have been picked up on a number of different sensors in addition to trained observers, all that. So we do believe they're physical. We don't know what they are. And right there, you've got the two key elements. They're in the air. We can't identify them, so they're unidentified. And they're, the problematic word is flying. What they're doing doesn't really qualify as flying as we understand it in a lot of cases, because flying involves having flight surfaces, wings, rotors, jet exhausts. Some of them don't have any of that, but they're still somehow in the air, so like they're sort of technically flying. So they basically are UFOs, and the report said, you know, yeah, in all but one instance, there were things that were in the air and we couldn't identify them. So they basically said, yeah, UFOs are real. And that was the first time. The rest of the report, you know, are they a threat? Well, anything that's hanging around over your battle groups, anything that's hanging around over your nuclear weapons facilities, and you don't know what it is, and it's just boldly zipping around, certainly a potential threat, right? You want to know what those things are. So there's probably a lot more in the classified version. I was just talking earlier tonight with John Greenwald from Black Vault. He's already started a hammering effort to get them to declassify part of the classified report that was given to the Senate and the House. And if we get that, maybe we'll get a few more clues. But for now, I think half a loaf is better than none. Instead of coming out and saying, oh, this is nothing, there's nothing to see here, move along, which we got from the last five government studies that have been done since the 50s, you know, now they came out and said, yeah, you're right. There's something out there. It's real. We don't know what it is. We're checking into it. We need more resources. We're going to put some people on this and see what we can find out. So I'm not that disappointed as some people were, but I would call it a good start.
Yeah, we'll see. You can't go back. They already put their foot in the mud. They can't pull it out.
Right. No. And that's, we've got that one spike in the wall. All right. That's not going back. Where does it go from here? That's the question. You know, they're going to be establishing a permanent group apparently at the command of the DOD that's going to replace the task force, because task force is it's a temporary term by definition. So if we're going to have a permanent group, I don't know how big it's going to be, how well funded it'll be, but they're going to keep exploring this and supposedly analyzing these reports. They have reporting systems in place. A lot of movement, you know, they're going to be recording all this. So hopefully we'll have a follow-up maybe in another 6 months or next year. We'll see.
I sure do hope so, but it does say preliminary. So that means that we will be getting something. Hopefully it will be released to the public though.
Unless they lied. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. Oh, the government never lies. What was I thinking?
Oh, well, hopefully they're going to hold their end of the bargain and give us a real report. John says, 46,000 miles per hour, 90 degrees, turns at hypersonic speeds, instant stop and accelerations, appear and disappear at will, suborbitable 20 feet in 0.78 of a second. Elizondo and Mellon admitted this so far. Thoughts, Mr. Shaw?
I've commented on that many times. We have no reason to disagree with that. We have heard testimony from a lot of this data came from the radar operators who have come forward and spoken publicly about it. We have a few instances where video has been released from the radar data, which is where we get most of that. And yeah, that was mostly the 2004 event. The objects had been detected for many days, but when they really started getting a good lock on them, they went from 80,000 feet down to just above sea level in less than a second.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, everybody seems to agree, everybody who's seen the data and examined the data and people who were there at the time agree that that's what happened. That's also impossible. You can't go 80,000 feet in less than a second without making a sonic boom, at least to human understanding.
That's right.
But something apparently did it. Now the question is, how did they do it? And more importantly, who the hell are you? Where did you come from? Where did you learn how to do this? We'd like to be able to do that, you know, but we can't, to anybody's knowledge, at least that I've spoken to. So yeah, no, that's my take on it. I mean, those are some of the most compelling elements of the stories. If you think the Russians and the Chinese have technology like that, then A, we're totally screwed. And B, why are we so far ahead of them and everything else if they've got technology like that? If we've got technology like that, why aren't we using it? I mean, it seems like it would be incredibly useful. I mean, there's a lot of other aspects, non-military, to that. If we had that kind of technology, you would have virtually free, limitless energy. Free energy forever.
But then it's not profitable, you know? Free energy isn't profitable.
Yeah, we can get into the whole rabbit hole of, oh, they don't want us to have free energy because it ruins capitalism or whatever. But there's so many other uses for it. And how long can you keep something like that secret? I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible. You know, maybe somebody's done something and they've kept an amazing secret for an incredibly long period of time. But boy, it just doesn't sound likely to me. That's only an opinion. It's not, you know, scientific analysis. There are many secrets out there all the time with the government, but boy, that would be a whopper of a secret to keep for what, 70 years since World War II?
Yeah.
And nobody's leaked it. Nobody else has figured it out. I don't know. Just my opinion strikes me as improbable.
Well, you have a lot of knowledge under your belt. I want to let the people know that are watching that we have about 5 more minutes of this live. If you guys have any questions, please shoot them out. And for all the Patreon supporters, you will be getting an extra exclusive, about 10 to 15 minutes extra. So if you're not a Patreon supporter, get on that today so you can get an exclusive with Jazz Shaw and all the previous guests.
Yes, so, and if you're on the Patreon, you'll be hearing about the Dolphins. So get on the Patreon.
And again, the Discord server will be open tomorrow for the public. So keep an eye out for my Twitter so that you can have access to all of the discussions that we have on Discord. And I definitely want to say thank you, James Coop, for the donation. Awesome. Thank you so much. John has another question, and he says, Mr. Shaw, what do you think are the chances that the government will admit that at least some of these events going back more than 70 to 80 years are non-human in origin? Should we be hopeful or is it hopeless?
In the short term, if those are my choices, hopeless. In the long term, maybe. We've seen how they handle the question. They've had to take a huge step to say, we don't know. The government, particularly the military, doesn't like to say we don't know. That's a terrible answer. They're charged with protecting us. They're charged with guarding our airspace. They're charged with making sure that we're safe. And now somebody comes up and goes, hey, there's all these Tic Tacs floating around, and one of them just shut down some of our nuclear weapons facilities. What happened there? We don't know is a terrible answer for them, because it makes it look like
they're idiots.
You know, we don't know, so you might be screwed. That's if you're, whether you're in the government or the military, you never want to give that answer. That's why the report was such a huge step, because they are saying, yeah, we've seen this stuff. We've We've gotten data, and this is happening, but it's still classified as unidentified, which they're basically saying, we don't know. That's a really hard answer for the government to give, because it lessens faith in the government, in the military. Are you protecting us? Keeping us safe? Are we in control? Are we secure? And they're like, mostly, except for maybe these aliens, we don't know. You know, nobody wants to say that.
No.
So, you know, if they have a lot more knowledge that they haven't released, then maybe, to answer John's question, you know, if they get comfortable to the point where they can say, okay, well, actually, we do know a little more about this, but it's not a threat to us, they'd be comfortable with that answer if they weren't letting the cat out of the bag too far. But if my theory is correct, and really they don't know that much more than we do, which is my personal theory, I have no proof for, they really hate to say that. They really don't want to say that, because it's like, we're in charge. We can handle the Russians. We can handle the Chinese. We can handle North Korea and Iran. And we have our allies, and they have all these things, and we have these arsenals, and we know what it is. Except there's these other guys, you know. And I think it's a very uncomfortable subject for the government to tackle.
Curious George says, question, what do you think of the idea that our tech was inspired by alien tech? I don't see why not. Answered it. Done. Yes.
There's two levels to that. The first one is, do we have, and there's a lot of theories out there and claims, have we actually already recovered non-human intelligence technology? And did we build things based on what we learned from that? Now we're going down the whole rabbit hole with Bob Lazar. But there's another level. Anytime humanity has looked at a really challenging problem and nobody knew whether or not it was even a thing we could do, you go a long time without knowing anything. But once humanity sees something or thinks they see something and says, wow, that's possible, we are some pretty clever monkey people, and then we figure out how to do it. The best example I will give you and the listeners before we finish
wrap it up,
is that when the Wright brothers actually had the first powered flight, 2 weeks after that, Anybody who wants to go Google this, go check it out. There were articles in New York City, in San Francisco, a number of other large outlets who claimed it was a hoax. They said it never happened because powered manned flight was still a century ahead of us. We just didn't have the technology. This was a joke. But once it was proven that the Wright brothers had flown, 5 years later, there were tons of people building flying machines. 60 years later, which in the history of evolution is a blink of the eye, we were on the moon. Once you show us that something's possible, we do tend to figure it out. So I think that might be one really good thing with UFOs, with UAP. If we see unbelievable characteristics that are actually happening, we have some bright people that start going, how'd you do that? And they start thinking. So even if we don't get a Tic Tac in our hands, maybe it's going to inspire us to have a big breakthrough in technology. And wouldn't that be awesome?
Absolutely. Okay, everyone, I really want to thank Jazz so much for staying up late to join me for this week's show. We are running on a short show this week because of time constraints, but it's been so awesome. I've learned some really awesome stuff as well. And I want to thank everyone for joining me to hear today, Jazz, everyone in the live chat, all of my Patreon supporters as well. And stay tuned on my Twitter feed because I'm going to have some really great shows coming up on the next week. Again, I want to thank all of my Patreon supporters. I could not do this without your kind support. Everyone, please take care. Have a great weekend. Jazz, do you want to say where we can find you on social media?
I really only do Twitter, so at Jazz Shaw, JazzShaw. I don't really do the other social media, so just hang out there. You'll find out a lot about horseradish, martinis, UFOs, and occasionally my pictures of my pets.
And we'll have to have another live stream where you can teach us how to do a martini in 2 minutes or less.
Yep.
I want to learn. I want to learn on that.
Hey, but we'll do that. I have the example right here. I can show you in no time at all. Maybe we can do that on Patreon next time.
Ooh, I'm ready for it. So thank you, everyone, so much. And remember, keep your eyes on the skies.